The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Try a month in print and online for free. And, for a limited time only, get a free wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger to start today.
Hello and welcome to Audio Reads. On the podcast this week, we have Katie Bors on the long-term impact of the Dominic Cummings affair, Dr. John Lee on the problem with the way we're counting COVID deaths, and Lionel Shriver on how life isn't worth living without a little risk. First, Katie Bors on Dominic Cummings.
When the Cabinet met by conference call on Monday, three ministers spoke in support of Dominic Cummings: Jacob Rees-Mogg, Suella Braverman, and Priti Patel. Their sentiments were not universally shared. "Several of us started feeling ill when Jacob opened his mouth," says one attendee. "Silence from the parliamentary party is damning," they add. But many critics of Cummings now think that, having dug in so deeply, the Prime Minister has to keep his man. To need to fight this much for an aide is bad enough, but to fight and lose would be devastating. This explains the energy behind the pursuit of Cummings in the past few days. The disclosure that Boris Johnson's senior aide travelled 260 miles from London during lockdown isn't just an easy issue on which to criticise the government. It's also provided the Prime Minister's critics with their biggest chance yet at destabilising Johnson's operation. It became clear pretty quickly that this was not about the fate of one advisor, but about the authority of the PM and the viability of his government. Anyone unconvinced need only look at the lengths taken to protect Cummings. He was given a personal press conference in the Downing Street Rose Garden, once used for the coalition announcement. The Prime Minister offered his full backing at two further press conferences. A slew of cabinet members were sent out to offer their support. And a review of lockdown childcare penalties was even mooted by the Health Secretary. "If it were anyone else, he would no longer be in place," says the minister. But Cummings is not as important as an average cabinet member. He's far higher up. When Sajid Javid, as Chancellor, came to blows with Cummings, he asked Johnson to choose between them. He found out the hard way where the PM's loyalties lie. Tory MPs have long been uncomfortable with all this, and the idea of an all-powerful number 10 issuing orders. Now that Cummings is in the firing line, they spy an opportunity to try and change things. When they worked together in education, Michael Gove described Cummings as his demon, the animal manifestation of a person's inner self from Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials, who fed off his instincts and did things that he, as a minister, would not dare. Cummings' work ethic, his effectiveness, and his lack of interest in the opinions of critics tend to get results. He helped Gove pass the Academies Act in 66 days, he helped Johnson win the Brexit referendum, and then helped him secure a Tory majority of 80 against all the odds. His style is to work with a tight team, taking quick decisions. To apply these methods in a system supposedly run by cabinet government was always going to cause tension. The weekly cabinet meeting has become more decorative, with many of those present sensing that they are going through the motions. The cabinet is already split in two. The inner cabinet, Gove, Matt Hancock, Dominic Raab and Rishi Sunak, are on the Prime Minister's morning coronavirus call, where key decisions are taken and information is shared. Several of those cabinet ministers not present, nicknamed the outer cabinet, have grown resentful of being left in the dark. Cabinet ministers see in the latest drama an opportunity to change the power balance to their advantage. "He will struggle to command the same respect as before, or even to give orders," argues one. Others agree. "We need to stop treating him as some high prophet rather than an advisor," they add. The lockdown hawks are pressing for a change in tone on social distancing, altering the emphasis so that everything is allowed except for specific things, like certain industries remaining closed, on the grounds it would provide the most clarity in the current climate. While ministers may be working out how to get the upper hand, it's the backbenchers who will prove harder to control. Even before this episode, Number 10 put little time into wooing MPs or nurturing party morale. It's harder to do in lockdown. It took Johnson several weeks to hold a Zoom call with his party troops. aides and whips have already been facing up to the reality that a majority of 80 doesn't allow you to just do what you like. A recent U-turn on the NHS migrant surcharge showed that. The speed at which Tory MPs have gone public to criticise Cummings should give further food for thought. The rebellion runs deeper than the usual suspects. As well as old foes including Damien Collins and Steve Baker, a raft of new MPs in the Red Wall have aired concerns. If you don't have your new intake on side, what are you even doing? Complains one bemused MP. A usually loyal MP says they have been looking for reasons to support Number 10 through this, but are struggling to find them. I don't have any axe to grind, but it's hard to defend. In the court of opinion, this is an unwinnable case, they add. Some have at least found a line to argue. Supportive MPs have been telling sceptical colleagues that this will end up a storm in a Westminster teacup. Look, they say, at the fate of David Cameron's spin doctor Andy Coulson. In the end, nobody cared about Coulson, they say. Though it didn't exactly end well. But the Cummings drama is a story as much about the Prime Minister as it is the aide. That Johnson had become so reliant on any individual has triggered alarm. His decision to spend so much political capital keeping his aide in place has led to questions over his judgment. Put it this way, it's crystallised people's sense that we are not handling this crisis right, says a moderate Conservative MP. A lot of people are openly saying, can Boris Johnson do this, they add. At the start of a five-year parliament, there is time for wounds to heal and time to reform Whitehall in a way that removes the need for a Svengali. This is, oddly enough, Cummings' stated mission, as of his blog in January, to hire more people and make himself largely redundant by Christmas. But for now, there is no one like him, no one the Prime Minister needs more. The battle to depose him will continue for some time yet.
That was Katie Bors. And now, Dr. John Lee, on what he thinks is the problem with the way we're counting COVID deaths.
As a pathologist, I'm used to people thinking that my job mainly involves dealing with death, but nothing could be further from the truth. That is why I and many of my colleagues are so dismayed by changes introduced during the coronavirus epidemic, which mean that pathology has not been able to play the role that it should have in helping to understand this new disease. The word pathology tends to conjure up images of body bags, mortuaries, and murder investigations. Ho ho, people say, your patients can't answer back. They imagine days spent trudging across fields to reach murder scenes, silent witness style, and nights sifting through arcane evidence to catch the perpetrators. And a rare type of pathologist, the forensic pathologist, does indeed do that. Most pathologists, though, spend the majority of their careers looking after the living. After all, pathology is the study of disease, and the whole point of knowing about diseases is to inform our approaches to preventing and treating them. There are four main types of pathologists. Microbiologists specialise in the study of infectious diseases. A subtype is the virologist, in particular demand at the moment. Chemical pathologists are expert in the liquid parts of the blood. They analyse the endless samples that pour into path labs day and night, looking for changes in chemicals and hormones that indicate disease. And haematologists are experts in diseases of the blood cells, the red cells and the white cells, that can cause problems such as anemia or leukemia. And then there is my own specialty of histopathology or cellular pathology. We are experts in analysing changes in the fabric of our bodies that result from disease. Many diseases affect our tissues in ways that can be seen down the microscope, allowing them to be accurately diagnosed and monitored, particularly tumours and inflammations. Every time a biopsy or surgical sample is taken, it comes to the histopathology lab to be examined. Histopathology is often regarded as a gold standard for diagnosis of diseases that change tissue structure. A clinical examination or x-ray may suggest that a tumour or fibrosis of the lung, say, is present, but you need to examine a tissue sample microscopically to be sure that it's really there, what type it is, and how advanced. Tissue can also be examined genetically to look for the presence of infectious agents or cellular receptors that may determine how deadly it is. The other thing that some histopathologists do is autopsies. Hence the confusion with forensic pathology. But in this case, the autopsies are not typically looking for evidence of foul play. They are usually requested by a coroner to ascertain the cause of death. Relatives, even doctors, are often surprised by the need for this in the world of modern medicine. Surely all the examinations, tests, and imaging carried out in life mean that the treating doctors know what was wrong with the patient when they die. But no, it turns out that autopsies often reveal the unexpected. Tests and images can be misleading, and treating doctors may have fixed ideas about what the matter is based on first impressions or incomplete evidence. Autopsy, autopsis, literally means seeing for oneself, and the person doing that should be clear-eyed, an independent specialist medical practitioner with no emotional or professional vested interest in what happened to the patient. Autopsy studies typically show major discrepancies between actual findings and clinical diagnosis in a quarter to a third of cases. And in about a sixth of cases, knowing about these hidden pathologies in life could have made differences to treatment that might have prevented death. In the UK in recent decades, about one in six deaths have had an autopsy examination, a deceased person's last gift to the living. The results contribute to maintaining and improving care, verifying and upholding the standards of public health statistics, preventing diagnostic drift, and basically keeping medicine honest. Autopsies also allow sampling of tissues from more organs than is usually possible in life, facilitating molecular and genetic studies. And nowhere are autopsy studies more important than in the study of new diseases and new treatments. The best example of this in recent years was acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS. When AIDS first appeared in the early 1980s, no one knew what it was, how it affected victims, how to treat it, or what effects its potential treatments had. Knowledge about all of these aspects was substantially acquired by study of tissue samples taken during life, and by autopsy examinations, with study of samples acquired after death. There was much uncertainty and worry at the time about how the disease was spread and possible contagion to healthcare workers and to the general population, but work continued and the results were of immense help in understanding the disease and developing treatments. Looking at the current crisis, the response so far has been very different. We are still struggling to understand coronavirus. I can think of no time in my medical career when it has been more important to have accurate diagnosis of a disease and understanding of precisely why patients have died of it. Yet early on in the epidemic, rules surrounding death certification were changed in ways that make the statistics unreliable. Guidance was issued which tends to reduce rather than increase referrals for autopsy. Normally, two doctors are needed to certify a death, one of whom has been treating the patient or who knows them and has seen them recently. That has changed. For COVID-19 only, the certification can be made by a single doctor and there's no requirement for them to examine or even met the patient. A video link consultation in the 4 weeks prior to death is now felt to be sufficient for death to be attributed to COVID-19. For deaths in care homes, the situation is even more extraordinary. Care home providers, most of whom are not medically trained, may make a statement to the effect that a patient has died of COVID-19. In the words of the Office for National Statistics, this may or may not correspond to a medical diagnosis or test result or be reflected in the death certification. From the 29th of March, the numbers of COVID deaths have included all cases where COVID-19 was simply mentioned on the death certificate, irrespective of positive testing and whether or not it may have been incidental to or directly responsible for death. From April the 29th, the numbers include the care home cases simply considered likely to be COVID-19. So at a time when accurate death statistics are more important than ever, the rules have been changed in ways that make them less reliable than ever. In what proportion of COVID-19 mentions was the disease actually present? And in how many cases, if actually present, was COVID-19 responsible for death? Despite what you may have understood from the daily briefings, the shocking truth is that we just don't know. How many of the cases during the epidemic are due to COVID-19, and how many are due to our societal responses of healthcare reorganisation, lockdown, and social distancing? Again, we don't know. Despite claims that they're all due to COVID-19, there's strong evidence that many, perhaps even a majority, are the result of our responses rather than the disease itself. It might have been possible to check these proportions by examining the deceased. But at a time when autopsies could have played a major role in helping us understand this disease, advice was given which made such examinations less likely than might have otherwise been the case. The Chief Coroner issued guidance on the 26th of March, which seemed designed to keep COVID-19 cases out of the coronial system. The guidance said, "The aim of the system should be that every death from COVID-19 which does not in law require referral to the coroner should be dealt with via the death certification process." And even guidance produced by the Royal College of Pathologists in February stated, In general, if a death is believed to be due to confirmed COVID-19 infection, there is unlikely to be any need for a post-mortem examination to be conducted, and the medical certificate of the cause of death should be issued. We need proper information to inform our responses to the virus, both clinical and societal. Instead, we have no idea how many of the deaths attributed to COVID-19 really were due to the disease, and we have no idea how many of the excess deaths were really due to COVID-19 or to the effects of lockdown. Officials should be releasing, as a matter of urgency, detailed information on the surge in deaths, both apparent COVID and non-COVID, particularly in care homes. How many are dying of COVID acquired in hospitals? Data presumably exists on this too, but is not released. The first rule in a pandemic should be to ensure transparency of information. Without it, errors can go undiscovered and lives can be lost. We will never be able to find out for sure now what this disease was like or what it did in the early stages of the crisis. One of the unappreciated tragedies of this epidemic so far is the huge lost opportunity to understand COVID-19 better. We like to beat ourselves up for having the worst COVID death toll in the UK in Europe, but we will never now know because we decided not to count properly. In a country that's always prided itself on the quality of its facts and figures, the missing COVID-19 data is a national scandal.
That was Dr. John Lee. And now Lionel Shriver, who asks, is living without risk really living at all?
Taking my life in my hands, as we all do when getting out of bed. I walked along the Thames last week, on the northern footpath east of Blackfriars Bridge. A young man ran atop the adjacent wall and jumped across a gap in the brickwork. The gap was 6 feet long. The wall is high. Had he missed, he'd have met all manner of hazards on either side. He gained nothing overt from that leap, only an ephemeral sense of satisfaction. It risked broken bones or a fractured skull. As he turned heel in preparation for repeating the feat, I was both aghast and impressed. We could call that young man foolhardy. Yet I wager that an ephemeral sense of satisfaction is precious to someone in his 20s. And could in time transfer to making leaps of a metaphorical sort later in a career. When I was young, I took an enormous leap of faith by committing to becoming a novelist, a risk of which I was underaware at the time, which to most clued-up observers was foolhardy in the extreme. The age group most inclined to elevate safety to the highest of virtues is the elderly. Old people are more physically fragile. The shank of their lives is behind them, including their own feats of daring do. While there are many delightful exceptions, seniors as a cohort are most likely to value tranquility and protection from harm over new exploits and adventures. Societies also have stages of life. By locking down during the coronavirus pandemic, you knew I'd get to that. The whole Western world has clung to safety above all else. We've willingly traded prosperity, functionality, joy, good company, and the productive futures of upcoming generations for short-term security. That's a security narrowly defined as well. Individual medical security, as opposed to the broader, more long-term security of a sound economy and a thriving community. Hysterical safetyism is the mark of a society that has passed its peak. The West has subsided to a geriatric phase of high anxiety and low expectations. With safety as a prime directive, Sir Ernest Shackleton would never have come anywhere near the South Pole because he might have got cold. David Livingstone would have found Victoria Falls only in order to wash his hands in it. Sir Francis Drake could never have set sail because rubberized non-slip decking had yet to be invented. Winston Churchill would certainly not have sanctioned Dunkirk because someone might have got hurt. Given how popular this domestic pastime has proved during lockdown, Sir Ranulph Fiennes would surely have spurned Mount Everest for the staircase in his house, after taking a course in proper stair-climbing technique from his local council, donning knee pads and a crash helmet, and stopping for frequent water breaks to remain hydrated. Perhaps in future we'll adulate a whole different set of national heroes. We'll give Olympic medals to gymnasts who realize that flipping around uneven parallel bars is terribly dangerous, and so have prudently sat out their athletic careers in a chair. The winner of the Tour de France will be the cyclist who never rides faster than 8 miles an hour and remembers to wear sunscreen. We'll award the Victoria Cross to the safest member of the armed forces in the presence of the enemy, who comes under bombardment and hides in the boot of his jeep, or who safely joins the other side if it seems to be winning. Look, I wear seatbelts. During the pandemic, I've not been bursting into COVID wards and begging positive patients to lick my face. Cycling down steep hills these days, I tend to ride the brake a tad. But I recognize that giving the thrill of speed a miss in order to handle the unexpected is a sure sign that I'm getting old. Accepted when COVID first hit, available data was patchy. But before the UK's lockdown, smaller studies already pointed towards what the US Centers for Disease Control, hardly a hotbed of libertarian nutjobs, announced last week. The infection fatality rate of COVID-19 is nowhere near 3.4% as first feared, but around 0.26%. Seasonal flu's IFR is 0.1%, 0.2% in an especially bad year. Thus, COVID-19 is barely more lethal than a bad flu. True, flu can be wretched and even fatal, but we live with that risk every winter. Now that this, you'd think, comforting information is in, most Britons are still cowering in place. When guests on the news say, "There's no such thing as perfect safety," or, "We always live in a world of competing risks," these self-evident bromides fall on deaf ears. You can't prove a negative. It's impossible to demonstrate that schools or workplaces are not unsafe. If early humans were too frightened to leave the cave to hunt for food, none of us would be here. What's wrong with you people? What's made this country so formidable for 1,000 years? Being incredibly careful. Meanwhile, isolating school children within chalk circles may have a negligible epidemiological effect, but a profound psychological one. We're inculcating chronic fearfulness in our kids, who will skip from the helplessness of infancy to the neurotic hyper-caution of old age, with no moon landings in between. We've prioritized the preservation of life in a literal short-term sense, possibly losing more lives than we've saved once the collateral damage totals are in, while giving no priority to everything that makes life worth living, like the experience of bravery that young man leaping a gap in the wall relished last week. Worse, we've thrown the future of a generation under a bus. Safety is fine as far as it goes, but it's not the driver of a vibrant culture. Safety is about stasis. If all you care about is safety, you never leave the house, lockdown or no lockdown. Obsession with safety is the very opposite of ambition. No wonder China is flexing its muscles. The Western response to COVID-19 is an ominous sign of civilizational senescence.
That was Lionel Shriver. Thanks for listening to this episode of Audio Reads, and do join us again next week. And remember, if there's anyone in particular you'd like to hear from or any feedback you'd like to give to us on any of our podcasts, not just this one, do just email podcast@spectator.co.uk. We do read all of your emails. Thanks so much for listening, and join us again next week.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Try a month in print and online for free. And, for a limited time only, get a free wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger to start today.